We've got Bob Ballard on. All right, so let me do this. Let's swing around, and we were going to hear from Mr. Ballard at 11:30, but since he's on, I'm so excited to speak with him. We can even have longer with this gentleman, Bob Ballard. His recent memoir is called Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. This man is truly a legend. I had the great pleasure of hearing him speak in 1993 at a conference in Scottsdale, Arizona, where he wouldn't remember. Why should he? I was in the audience, absolutely, totally mesmerized by this idea that 70% of the world's surface had barely been tapped in terms of exploration. While we were busy looking up, we weren't looking down. And so I'm so excited to introduce you to Bob Ballard, who lives in Connecticut, who has been an extraordinary steward of the resources up in Mystic, Connecticut, and who was one of the world's leading oceanographers and explorers. Mr. Ballard, I'm so happy to have you on the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hello and good morning.
Good morning, Lisa. No, it's great to be on. Lovely day. Still, when are we going to get a little warmth in this spring? What do you know?
It's been cold.
A little nippy.
It has been a little nippy. So, Bob, I'm sure that you don't remember, because you probably speak everywhere and have forever. But it was a long time ago at the Princess Hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona, and you were speaking to a group of Arthur Andersen professionals, and I was there as a wife.
Yeah, that's a lovely place there, you know. That's quite lovely.
Quite a nice place. I thought so.
Not quite.
And there you were.
But close, right?
right. And there you were, and you said that the world was so busy looking up that we hadn't bothered to explore the great oceans of the world. And I was just stunned.
Well, even crazier, 50%, think about that, 50% of the United States of America is beneath the sea. America owns more land underwater than any other nation on Earth, yet we spent $1 billion mapping Mars and have yet to map half the United States. Crazy.
Is that because it's the waters between here and Alaska or here in Hawaii? What waters do we own?
200 miles around all of the land we own on land. If you go and stand on the shores of Connecticut and you go out 200 miles or off, you know, Cape Cod or anywhere, we own out 200 miles, and we actually can apply, if the continental shelf continues like in the North Slope of Alaska, you can claim even more. So when you add it all up, remember, we own a lot of rocks out in the Pacific Ocean, the whole Hawaiian Islands, Guam, Northern Marianas, American Samoa, on the list goes. It adds up to an equal amount of land underwater than is above water. And so we're now just beginning to mount what we call the second Lewis and Clark expedition. But since my team is 55% women, we call it the Lois and Clark expedition to map that great underwater real estate. And that project begins in a matter of months.
It does. Wow. So when we talk about mapping it, What do you mean by mapping it? What are you going to be looking for and noting on the maps?
Well, first and foremost, our ship. I have my own ship, the EV Nautilus, because my hero was Captain Nemo, as you read in the book.
Uh-huh.
And that ship has on the bottom of it a multi-million dollar, what used to be a top secret sonar system when I was in the Navy, called a multi-beam sonar system. And you can literally go at full speed and map in three dimensions, 7 kilometer swath width in 4,000 meters. So you can literally digitize the ocean floor and make a highly accurate topographic map, because what people don't realize is the largest mountain ranges are under the ocean. There's canyons down there that make the Grand Canyon look like a ditch. So before you can do anything, you need, on land we call it a topographic map. Underwater we call it a bathymetric map. Same thing, a three-dimensional characterization of the terrain. That's step one. And then after you've mapped it, then we launch a vast array of underwater vehicle systems that are only getting more and more complicated now, to go down and literally physically explore it visually. And what we do is it's all being beamed back live, so you can watch it too. If you go, we set sail on July 3rd. So write that down. If you go to nautiluslive.org, I will be sailing out of California July 3rd to use this technology. And you can literally come into the command center with us. It's wild.
This is so, you know, aren't you, listen, Bob Ballard, you're the reason to some extent that we are where we are. But aren't you so excited to be alive to see these? I mean, to see the leaps and bounds of how the technology is catching up with your imagination?
It is. It's true. I turned 79, so rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated, as Mark Twain would say. I have been at this for 65 years. I've conducted 157, going on 58, expeditions. And people say, well, why are you doing it now? Well, before we launch this massive 10-year program, I thought, let's take it, you know, let's wrap it up on what I've been doing for so many years. And also, the book, it's the first time I've written a lot of different Titanic, Bismarck, you know, lots of different books, but I've never talked about myself. I had a wonderful, I wrote a book for called Eternal Darkness, got a great review out of the New York Times years ago. They said we didn't ever learn a thing about the explorer. And so National Geographic came to me, ironically, just before the pandemic, so I was able to take advantage of being landlocked to write a book that really got personal. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at
it. I did.
I knew I was different. I followed a brilliant older brother who was just the smartest human being on the planet. And then there was me. And I had trouble reading. And I didn't know at the time that I was dyslexic, but I'm dyslexic. And I learned it through my daughter when she was diagnosed at school in Madison, Connecticut here, that she was dyslexic. And I got this book called The Dyslexic Advantage, and I must say, I read slow, but I stayed up all night, read that book, and literally cried because it explained me to me for the first time. It explained why I am who I am and how I'm able to turn this into an advantage. And I view now my dyslexia as a gift that I've been given. And there's a lot of successful people who are dyslexic. Steven Spielberg, Michelangelo, Picasso, Ted Turner, on the list goes, Whoopi Goldberg, all dyslexic. But then there's a high suicide rate amongst dyslexics. And so, you know, I want to reach out to those kids that are having trouble and saying, if I can make it, you can make it. So a big part of this book is to talk to that 15 to 20% of our population are dyslexic, but they won't talk about it. They've been told they're stupid, they're ashamed to talk about it, and they should not be ashamed. They should be celebrating it.
Well, one of the things we're chatting with Robert Ballard, the legendary oceanographer, is that you only got like a 440 on the verbal SATs. I saw that. And yet you managed, because of your own moxie personality, to some extent the connections with your father, you were able to find your way into a first-class education.
Yep.
Part of the problem with a lot of kids with dyslexia is that they can't find their way into that first-class education with those scores.
Well, I was lucky. I was the university. I had good grades. It was this tests. I went on my sword. I had good grades in high school. I had mostly A's, A minuses. My brother had all the A pluses. But I was grew up in California. I was born in Kansas, where all oceanographers come from. But then my father, I was born 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and he moved the family to California, and he became a test flight engineer with Chuck Yeager. I woke up in the Mojave Desert.
He was so brave. You come from very courageous people.
Well,
they're
cowboys. You know, my grandfather shot in a gunfight. You know, I mean, he was on the good side, but he got killed by a kid, literally, ironically, on drugs at the time. Back in 1920, my father was 5 years old, and So he grew up on a ranch. By his mother died. He grew up with his aunt, who was married to a relative of Bat Masters. So yeah, I've come from good stock, but I'm 13th generation American, but the first to go to college, along with my brother. Wow. And not only we've got college degrees, we both got PhDs, but we were the first of our family. And so fortunately, I grew up where, you know what the tuition was at the University of California when I went to school there?
Probably
$98 a semester.
Not even. Okay. Yeah.
So I was lucky. I could mow lawns and get $98.
Yes.
So
yes.
I was lucky. Back then, education wasn't as expensive as it is today.
That's right.
I had
the
no
barriers
debt.
To entry. There were fewer barriers to entry, right? That's the
there
way
were.
You put it. We're chatting with Bob Ballard. It's true. And the other thing, I was reading about your wonderful childhood. Can you talk to us a little bit about the freedom that your parents gave you, notwithstanding the spanking once in a while for running away? But you had a lot of freedom as a human being to explore your environment and not worry about it and just come home when it was dark. What do you think about that as an aspect of parenting? Tell me what you think.
First thing I had was a bicycle. I'm ADHD. I'm standing right now walking around while I'm talking to you because I have so much energy, which is if you can. I have a son who's dyslexic as well, and I had on his mirror, it said, my body is like a race car, and when I learn how to drive it, I'm going to win lots of races. So I was learning how to handle that energy, but my mom would just say, just be home before it's dark, and I was off. And I was growing up in a Southern California at the time was not densely populated. And I found, you know, I live close to the ocean, tidal pools. I had a way of balancing my energy and then channeling myself. So it was really controlling my energy. So I sort of took on that philosophy, a strong mind and a strong body. So I was in athletics where I could get it out of me, and then I could sit down and study. But I knew I had to study longer. I had to read longer. So I just gutted it out.
Yeah, well, just gutting it out. I mean, that's a quality that we need to be encouraging in people.
Well, and again, it's also the field you go in. You need to go in a field where dyslexics excel. And I happen to go into geology, a field geologist. I'm an observational creature. Everything, I see things, but I also learned tricks to memorize my notes. I felt like I was cheating, but I would take a sheet of paper and I'd take a mental photograph of it in my head, and I'd go into the exam, close my eyes, and turn the pages, and there was the answer. So I learned how to take what I had and turn it to a positive outcome.
Can you tell us a little bit, we're chatting with Robert Ballard, a little bit about how you were able to be this extraordinary proselytizer, this missionary, when it came to ocean exploration in this country, because your impact has been phenomenal on advancing this beautiful area of knowledge that you love.
Well, as you read in the book, you know, I knew I wanted to be Captain Nemo.
Yes.
I mean, I saw the movie, didn't read the book, but that motivated me. My parents didn't laugh at my dreams. Mm. And that's the important thing. Every child has dreams. They have passions. And mine was to be Captain Nemo. And my parents, I'm sure, went into the other room and said, Houston, we got a problem here. But they didn't in front of me. They said, well, tell me more about Captain Nemo. I said, I had a submarine. Well, I lived in San Diego. They took me down, showed me the submarine. I became a naval officer in submarine. So they said, yeah, but it was more than a submarine. I said, yeah, it had a window open like the iris of a lens, and you could see the bottom of the – that sounds like an oceanographer. Right. I was living down the street from Scripps, the largest oceanographic institution. So my parents were able to shape this crazy dream into a career path that I could succeed at. So it was all about – your passion, and you should, you know, that's your driving engine. And get, again, being ADHD, being dyslexic, going down a path less traveled, you hit failure. And I learned that failure was the greatest teacher I ever met. and you work through it. You don't avoid failure. You process it and work through it. But what drives you through it is your passion. So always go with your passion.
One of the wonderful chapters in your book, we're chatting with Robert Ballard. The book is called Into the Deep, and it's a memoir. Is about how you discover Woods Hole and about how their reverse snobbery says to you, well, now you've come to the really best oceanographic institute in the world.
That was a funny moment because, you know, Scripps and Woods Hole were like, the competitors, and deep, and throughout the book was this competition. And it's sort of funny, as you discover, my first cruise as a 17-year-old was on a Scripps ship. And so I never heard about Woods Hole because I grew up on the West Coast. But then when the Navy gave me my orders and I end up on the East Coast, and one of the programs I work with was the diving program at Woods Hole. And I went in there and I thought I'd impress him by saying, yeah, I've been on research ships at Scripps. And he says, well, congratulations, you finally made it to the best. And so, yeah, there's that. Well, you know the Northeast, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I do. I'm a product of it.
I married it, I can tell you that.
Yes, yes. And so, Robert Ballard, and you also touch on the fact that your first wife, that she had trouble a little bit, and you say from an empathetic point of view, that she wasn't like some of the other professional scientific women that were at Woods Hole, and that might have been the beginning of where your relationship started to diverge a little bit.
Fundamentally, I had a brilliant mother, but again, none of my relatives ever went to college. And I also grew up in the 50s with Ozzie and Harriet, where there was one car and the father took it to work and the mother was home. I remember when the Helms came by with the donuts and the milkman came by and the grocery, everyone came to your house because the wife didn't have a car. And that's what America was all about. It was on television. Women are supposed to stay at home, et cetera, et cetera. And both my brother and I happily married what we thought was our mother in many respects. But the times had changed, and I embraced it, and academia embraced it. And when you lived in Los Angeles, you know, it's a big place. But when you come to Cape Cod, it's a very tiny place. And in that case, most of my colleagues' wives had all gone to college and had embraced it. And so, yeah, that was a difficulty that ultimately didn't survive, and certainly the death of my son was the end of it all in many regards. I mean, it's tragic when you lose a child and its impact.
Yeah, there aren't many couples that can withstand that, actually, Bob.
It has a devastating impact on many couples, and my son was just days away from 21. He'd just been to sea with me when we found the Bismarck, and boom. Didn't get to say goodbye.
Yeah, yeah. Terrible, terrible tragedy. I've interviewed a bunch of the parents from the new town.
Yeah, I had my two grandsons were there.
Is that right?
Yeah, they were at the other school. They lost three of their hockey buddies. I went through that too.
Oh, my God.
That was
so terrible.
Yeah, they live in Newtown now. I was there moments after it happened. I'd just been there because it was around Veterans Day, and we'd been there to celebrate. I served in the Army during Vietnam and the Navy during the Cold War, and I'd been there at a flag raising and ceremony where grandfathers came who were veterans, and they were at the other school. But when it came on the radio, I didn't know which one.
Oh,
and I
my
took
God.
Off. I came off the freeway at exit 84 right there at Sandy Hook. Yeah, it was, where are my grandkids?
Wow.
And they were all locked down. Yeah, that was a dark moment.
Terrible dark. And some of the parents that I've interviewed since have, they haven't been able to stay together.
Well, and particularly the ones that witnessed it and ran.
Yeah.
How? It's devastating. On my son's is divorced after that.
We're talking with Robert.
Really take a toll.
We're talking with Robert Ballard. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about when you ran the Mystic Aquarium Enterprise up there, some of the things that we here in Connecticut, you know, learned about our own seashore locally that maybe we don't know?
Well, I worked, actually, I'm no longer there, but I was there at the Institute for Exploration.
Yeah.
Now I have the Ocean Exploration Trust, which is right across the street from the Coast Guard Academy. It's right on the next to Lyman Allen Art Museum is where my headquarters are. But what I was doing was I was working with the Mashantucket Pequots, and there was a great archaeologist there, Kevin McBride. And Kevin and I began exploring right off here. You have to realize that during the Great Ice Age, it's called the Last Glacial Maximum, which was 12,000 years ago, down to 20,000 years ago, the sea level was much, much lower. And if you were to I live here in Lyme, and if I were to try to find the ocean, I'd go 100 miles across the continental shelf before I could find the ocean. And that was inhabited by Native Americans. And we've been exploring out here, and what you're looking for is what are called kitchen midden. And kitchen midden was, they ate a lot of clams and mussels, et cetera, and they would throw them in a pile. It was like a garbage dump. And it would be a big stack of shells. And you can go out there and you can find these ancient Indian encampments. And it's fascinating.
No,
we've also found woolly mammoth tusks. And it was a very different set of real estate out here not too many years ago.
That's amazing. Would you consider yourself as an oceanographer, an archaeologist of the ocean?
No, I'm sort of a generalist. My PhD is in marine geology and geophysics. I'm an earth scientist. I'm a field geologist. And a field geologist is just what I did as a kid. I walk about and I analyze what I see, but I do it in a much more systematic way than I did when I was a kid. But I find everything. I'm an explorer. I'm an equal opportunity explorer.
I see.
I'll find biology, geology, archaeology, maritime history. Explore. You boldly go where no one has gone before. And
it's
what
so exciting.
We will be doing with the Nautilus is you can go with us on the trip. So just go to nautiluslive.org as we explore the 50% of our nation that lies beneath the sea.
I got to ask you something, Bob. Today I saw that the first huge wind farm off of Martha's Vineyard is very close to being approved. Mm-hmm. And I actually had someone from National Geographic on the show not too long ago and asked him about it. And he said, because I'm worried about the impact on the mammals and on the ocean life. And he's like, well, on balance, we still have to get rid of the carbon in the air. So the ocean is vast and wide. He was basically telling me we have to study it more, but not to worry about it too much, because in the big picture, we have to get rid of some of this carbon and these fossil fuels. But I'm wondering, from your point of view, there's going to be this huge investment in wind farms and they're going to stand on the ocean floors. What are your thoughts about this? Is this a good or a bad thing?
Actually, very pro. We spend every summer on the block, and they've done a marvelous job. In fact, we go out there and it's pretty good fishing because they put, you know, the ocean is largely, in many cases, barren. And as soon as you add rocks, for example, you create an ecosystem. When shipwrecks, people actually go out and sink ships on purpose because they become an oasis. There's a huge amount of our bottom of the ocean that is barren. There's no place for little guys to hide. And so putting structures are actually lead to increase in diversity of the ecosystem. So I'm pro on wind. I'm also pro on nuclear energy. I'm pro on solar energy. The problem with solar and wind is it's not reliable. It's not constant, whereas nuclear energy is constant. So I think we need all of the above.
So you're not worried about disrupting whale noises or dolphin noises because of the noise?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
First place, most of these wind farms are put in very shallow water. This is not where you're going to find whales.
Okay.
They don't. They do not go in that shallow of water. I mean, once in a while. But no, I don't see that as a deterrent. I mean, the bigger deterrents are, you know, where you're generating very loud noises underwater.
Noise. Yes. Well, that's what I'm talking about.
But this is a very low frequency.
Okay. And what about the general health of our oceans in terms of the bleaching of coral reefs and things like that?
I'm in the middle of that for sure. Yes. Yeah. The global change is you're seeing acidification. We have one of our new big projects is studying 90% of the coral reefs within the American waters. For the next 5 years, our team will be exploring the 90% of all the coral reefs in American waters, and they're mostly in the Pacific, in the Central and Western Pacific. But yes, pollution, acidification, warming. What we're finding is corals are moving towards the poles, both north and south, about 14 kilometers a year. You're also getting coral variants that can tolerate warmer water. But clearly, we need to address global warming and global change. It's leading to mass extinction. And there's a new, well, not terribly new, but new to many people who have never heard of the concept of Gaia, G-A-I-A, and you want to read about it. It talks about the Earth being a living creature that's cohabitating with the rest of life on our planet. There's a great book. I'm supposed to be plugging my book, but please get my book, Into the Deep. But there's another one by a colleague of mine named Enrique Sala called The Nature of Nature. And it's a fascinating book about our planet and how codependent it is upon the planet and on life. And we have one species on this planet that's out of sync, and it's us.
Us, of course.
I'm not really worried about the Earth being around in another billion years. I'm not really worried about life being around in another billion years. I'm worried about the human race being alive another 50 years.
Well, you know what? Honestly, if that happens, we only have ourselves to blame.
Well, but we can do something about it. And, you know, one of the early things that President Biden did after being elected was to sign an executive order of 30 by 30 to preserve 30% of land and 30% of the ocean protected. That still leaves 70 and 70. But what we have found with the creation of sanctuaries, marine sanctuaries, is they become nurseries. And then you don't have the extinction of species, and they're actually breeding grounds that flow out of those sanctuaries. So a big part of our strategy is to figure out where is the best place to create marine sanctuaries. We have several of them now. You have Stillwagon Banks, a marine sanctuary. But we really need to look at expanding our marine sanctuaries because it makes economic sense. I think that's what people need to understand is the price tag of not creating sanctuaries is an amazing price tag.
Bob Ballard, I have to tell you, speaking with you, I feel like you're the Pied Piper. I do. I feel like if I was starting over, and I was terrible in science, so anything having to do with a number scared me away. That's why I became a lawyer. Anything having to do with numbers scared me. But if I was starting over right now and you were coming into my classroom or speaking, I would just have to follow you to wherever it is you're going, because the gift of your personality and your missionary zeal for learning, it's so beautiful. I feel so honored that you're on our show today to talk about your life.
I want to thank you so much for having me, and I hope others will get the book. I mean, Disney is now co-producing the National Geographic books. In fact, on my desk, I'll lift it up right now. It says, if you can dream it, you can do it, Walt Disney. Walt Disney was dyslexic. And they're producing my book as an e-book in dyslexic font.
Really?
Also an audio book of it. So they're coming out every which way with the book. And so, and also June 14th, on National Geographic Channel is a companion television special that follows the book as well.
Well, it's called Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. We didn't even talk about Titanic, which is going to disappoint everybody who's listening today. Give us one quickie before we say goodbye. How did you find out where the Titanic was going to be found? What was your aha moment to look for it?
This is one of the reasons for writing the book. It was a top secret mission I was on, and the Titanic was my cover. And the top secret mission was mapping two submarines that we lost during the Cold War, the Thresher and the Scorpion, that told me how to find the Titanic. And we don't have time to say it, but it's all in the book.
Oh, I know. It's great. It is great. So go get the book. It's called Into the Deep by Robert Ballard. First of all, a Connecticut treasure, but also very much the world's and our nation's. And we have a lot to thank you for, Robert Ballard.
Thank you for having me on your
leadership.
Show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much. Robert Ballard on the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back.